Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This episode of Know-How is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 38 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off any image file on your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code KNOWHOW714. And by Lynda.com. Learn what you want when you want with access to over 2,400 high-quality online courses, all for one low monthly price. To try it free for 7 days, visit lynda.com/knowhow. That's lynda.com/knowhow. On this episode of Know-How, we're going to show you everything you ever needed to know about getting started with Linux, and then we're getting kind of black hat with some ARP cache poisoning. Know-How. It's the Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. I'm Father Robert Palliser.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
For the next hour or so, we're going to show you some of the projects that we've been geeking out with, so hopefully you can take that home and find a little geek project of your own. But before we get there, Brian.
Yes?
We love this thing, right?
The little credit card-sized computer.
Credit card-sized computer that really kind of changed the face of project computing. This is the Raspberry Pi.
Delicious.
Very inexpensive, $35 computer, single board, that has pretty much everything you need to make a simple computer project controller box.
There's plenty of different projects out there to do. I mean, my favorite one was making the Retro Pi, which was a MAME arcade out of it and stuff. There's tons of things you can do with the Pi.
Right. We did the MAME machine. We did a camera controller. We've done a web server. We're doing a Tor server sometime in the very near future. So this is one of these boxes that has enough power for you to really kind of test the boundaries of what your programming / hardware hacking skills are.
Yeah, absolutely. It made it a lot easier for more people to have access to computers also, because I know in a lot of different countries, like I think Africa and stuff, they've been sending them there for kids to play with and kids to learn programming on it and stuff. So it's a great starter place for learning Python and things like that.
Yeah, Python, especially since it's got a very easy to install operating system. It runs Linux. You could have this thing up and running within 30 minutes or so from nothing, from just a memory card and the board itself.
Yeah.
It runs on next to no power. It's very, very power efficient.
5 volts, 2 amps, I think.
Exactly, and it does HDMI, it does Ethernet, it does 2 USBs, audio out, and digital audio out. So it's a decent board, but they've upgraded it.
Yes, because it's been 3 years since the Raspberry Pi has been out, and it's not, hardware-wise, it's not a significant upgrade. They kept the CPU the same, but they've added a few more USB ports, and they've switched from the SD card slot that's on the Raspberry Pi right now is the type where you just slide the card in and it's kind of, you hope that it's in there all the way. So they've gone to micro SD cards now, and it's more of a push kind of one. But the example we have here is the older version.
Yeah. So yeah, the new version is called the B+. And so this is the old version. I think this is probably a really good reason why people thought, it's okay, but I wish this was different. Yep. They don't like the memory card being stuck like this. It's just friction. There's no lock.
Right.
So if you accidentally jostle it, it's gonna pop out. The other thing is the mounting points are kind of irregular. You've got one point here, one point here. It doesn't stick in really, really well. The B+ has 4 mounting posts that are regular, so it's easier to mount this device.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. You've also got 4 USB 2.0 instead of 2 USB 2.0, which was a drawback of the original Pi. A lot of us had to put some sort of USB hub.
Yep, that's what we ended up doing for our NES project.
Right, which is a pain because, with something so small, you don't want a bunch of stuff hanging off of it.
Right.
Some of the other things that they did was they retracted everything into the board itself, the audio connector, the Ethernet connector, the USB connector, which gives you this nice squared-off shape.
Right.
So again, it's now they really understand who their audience is, people who want to take these and put them into other projects.
Yeah.
And that's what they built them for.
Well, that's the nice thing about the size of the Pi is that you can fit it into so many different things and different, like putting it in an NES case or making it portable and stuff like that.
Right. Now, one of the other things, I don't know if you'll notice here, but they've given the audio circuit, the audio chip, its own power supply. So it's a discrete power supply, which was a problem with the Pi, because if you use the audio out, not the HDMI, but the audio out, it was a little noisy.
Yeah, you get that hum in the background.
Right. So what you had to do is you ended up having to like get a really expensive USB supply so that you didn't get that meh.
I just ended up not using it.
Right. You use the HDMI because
exactly.
That's digital out. Well, now you can because they've isolated it from the rest of the Pi, which means if you wanted to use this as a music player, go right on ahead.
The Pi is evolving. The example I could think of is, you know how when the Xbox 360 came out, it was big, and then they slimmed it down?
Right.
It's kind of like that. Yeah, or the PS3 or the PS4. Yeah.
So it's like the Pi Slim.
Or Pi Slim.
Slice.
Pi Slim.
If you wanted to make a music player with it, you can make a Pi Pod.
A Pi Pod.
That's, I'm trademarking that. Patent pending.
Nobody steal that.
We're done now. Yeah, we're done now. Well, but it's $35, so it's the same price, which means that they're going to phase out the older ones.
I haven't seen a price drop on the older ones yet, but I imagine it'll probably go down a lot. Oh, they also added more GPU input.
Oh, that's right. So they've gone from the 26-pin GPIO, which is the header, so that you can connect things to have the Pi control it, to a 40-pin header, which will be nice because now you get more functionality. You can hook this up to more devices, you could trigger more events.
Yeah.
Essentially, they've turned the Pi into something that fits better into project enclosures and really caters to the project enthusiast. So,
That's cool.
You're going to see this a whole lot.
Yeah, I'm excited to play with it whenever we're able to get one.
So. Yeah. Now, one of the things that we've been working on here has been OS tips. We've done Windows.
Yes, we've done Windows.
You did OS 10.
We've done, Macintosh.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that we haven't done, and this has gotten us into a little bit of trouble, has been Linux.
Linux,
yeah. We did Linux anytime we did a Raspberry Pi project, because, of course, that's running Linux. But what we had to do most of the time was we black boxed it. We told you, okay, this is what you have to type. This is where you have to type it.
Yeah.
And people came back to us and said, wait a minute, we want to know what that means. Why do I put sudo? Why do I put apt-get? I don't get it. The problem is that
it's a pretty broad subject.
Yeah, it's a broad subject, and you kind of don't want to learn Linux by programming a Raspberry Pi. You want a full exposure to Linux. So what we did is we asked one of Twit's Linux experts, Aaron Newcomb, to come on and talk about what you need to pick a distro. So when you're choosing what flavor of Linux you want to start off with, Aaron's going to give you a couple of tips. But before we get to that, you know,
what?
I'm just thinking.
What, Padre?
I want one place, one easy place that I could go to.
Central
location where I could find media. I want pictures. I want videos. I want vectors. I want something that will let my creative side blossom.
And you need as much of that help as you can get.
I know, because I'm horrible at that, right? No, but seriously, I mean, one of the things that I've been doing the last couple of years is I've been helping my organization, the church, deal with a presence on the internet. And one of the things that you need is you need good graphics. You need good visuals. You need to be able to express yourself in something other than a nasty web page with just black and white text type stuff.
And when we're doing a show similar to Know How, I like to bring up certain images and videos during that show to, you know, make it pop.
And so when we're doing all of those things, we do need that one-stop shop to inspire us. And thankfully, we've got one. The first sponsor of this episode of Know How is Shutterstock. Now, Shutterstock is a one-stop shop for all your media needs. Now, you may be asking yourself, why do I need a one-stop shop for all my media needs?
Just easier that way.
It's easier that way, but Shutterstock is more than just a repository. I mean, if you just wanted a repository of images, go and buy yourself one of those clip art CDs. Go and surf the internet for some royalty-free videos or pictures. But that's not what Shutterstock is. They're a search engine for creativity.
Ugh, and they have so many good pictures.
They do. Now, Shutterstock, whether for your website, a publication, an advertisement, a video, or any other type of project, is the place you want to go to inspire you. You can choose for over 38 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips. Now, they source images from around the world and put them at your fingertips. A lot of the contributors to Shutterstock are professional photographers and artists, which means you're going to get quality images. You're going to get a lot of different views of the same subject. You're going to find exactly the thing that you want if you want to start talking about Raspberry Pi.
We need to stop searching food.
Yeah.
I think last time it was bacon.
Stop with the bacon. Now, Shutterstock reviews each image individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. So you're not going to get like a Google search where 90% of it is just junk. It's garbage. No, you're going to get high-quality images. You're going to get high-quality videos and high-quality vectors. They also have flexible pricing. You can choose individual image packs or monthly subscription for the best deal. You can download 25 images per day with a standard subscription. And you can download any image in any size, and you pay only one price. That's one of the things I really dislike about some of these services on the internet, which make you pay for every version of the photo or clip that you... No, that's not what Shutterstock does. You get the subscription, boom, get what you want, download as many times as you need, as many versions as you need. Now, Shutterstock also gives you the images you need to bring your creative projects to the next level. This is what I was talking about earlier, and they make it easier. They've got a sophisticated search tool. So, for example, I like this. Let's look for a hippo. I want a hippo again. I know we can do hippo.
Yes, please.
Yeah. So let's go for yeah. So now we've got hippos. But no.
What?
We need a purple hippo. Can we find a purple hippo? Because you know maybe I'm doing a project and I need a little a childish purple hippo thing going on. Wow. And see, I can even choose exactly what. There's got to be a purple hippo. Oh, yeah. You know, maybe you shouldn't be searching exactly for that because that, yeah.
Try
purple.
Angry.
How about just put purple? There we go. Thank you. Now, one of the things that I really like about Shutterstock is the ability,
there we go.
Thank you, to have shareable light boxes. You save images to a light box gallery, then you access them anytime and share them with other team members. So once I found my purple hippo, the hippo that I want, I can go ahead and drop it into my collection and share it with the other people who are on the project. That is your new logo, by the way. We're going to buy that for you. You know what? I'm buying that for you.
Thanks, Padre.
That's my wedding present to you.
Finally, something that I needed.
It's perfect, yeah. Now, they also have an award-winning iPad app, so it lets you search on the go and use it to display images during your presentation. And they're also a global marketplace. They have multilingual customer service in more than a dozen international countries and full-time customer support throughout the week. So here's what I want you to do. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like and save favorite images to a lightbox to review later. Once you decide to purchase, use the offer code KNOWHOW714 and new accounts will receive 20% off any image file. We thank Shutterstock for their support of KNOWHOW.
I spend so much time just playing on the website, not actually downloading anything.
I've never actually used the eyedropper tool. That's kind of cool. I mean, but it's super specific.
Yeah, very specific.
You'd have to exactly match the purple.
And
anyways, you know what, Alex? Run the video. Let's find out how we're going to choose our first Linux distro.
Hey, I'm Aaron Newcomb, and in this segment, we're going to be talking a little bit about Linux. A lot of people would like to get started with Linux, so we thought it might be nice to go through and talk about what the options are, how to get it installed, all that kind of stuff. So if you're an advanced user, you can probably just skip this whole section because you're going to know this already. But for a lot of you out there, you'd like to get started with Linux, but you don't know how. There's, you know, thousands of different distributions. Which one do you start with? And then how do I get it installed? What if I already have Windows installed? Could I install it on a Mac device? How do I install Linux alongside my existing operating system? So we're going to cover a lot of those topics. But for today, let's get started just with which distribution should I choose? What is a distribution, first of all? Well, a distribution of Linux is an operating system. And Linux is really just the kernel. Linux runs at the core. And then people build a whole operating system on top of that kernel so that you can get things like email and word processors and browsers to surf the net and all that kind of other stuff that comes on top of Linux. So when you start adding all those things together, then you have your own personalized distribution. And it's called a distribution because you distribute it out to the world and people can download it and install it on their devices. So that's what a distribution is. Today, we're going to take a look at and try to narrow down maybe ones that beginners should start with. So what's the difference between Ubuntu and Fedora, for example? Which one should I choose? So we're going to go ahead and start taking a look at that. And let's start with Ubuntu. Now, you'll notice when you go to the Ubuntu website, Ubuntu is all about cloud these days. In fact, just about everybody is. They have a big cloud push, but don't let that dissuade you. There are a lot of good ways to get started with just the desktop edition, which is what you want. You don't want the server edition. You don't want the cloud edition. You want to run this on your laptop or desktop. So you want the desktop edition. Now, what Ubuntu has done, which is really neat, is they have a tour. So if you hover over desktop or just scroll down to the bottom of the page, you'll find the link for Take the Tour. This is a really cool feature because what it does is it puts you in a Ubuntu desktop running out of your browser. So you can see, there we are. So this is what the Ubuntu desktop will look like once you get it installed. So it gives you a nice little preview. Now we're going to go ahead and show ourselves around. And you can see we're getting little tips over here, but this is what the desktop looks like. And you can see it's a little different from Windows or Mac. You know, Mac usually has a menu bar, and then they've got the little tray down here. With Windows, you've got the start menu, or on Windows 8, you've got a grid now, of course, the Metro style of applications and icons across your screen. With Ubuntu, they have a nice little menu bar over here on the side. It kind of stays out of your way. And to find an application, you can just click on that and start typing in the name of the application you want to find. In this case, we'll type in Firefox. And there's Firefox. So we can click on that, and Firefox comes up. Of course, this is all running in the browser. Not everything works, but the browser is surprisingly functional in this little tour that they've built to run in your browser, which is really, really cool. So Ubuntu is the most popular, it's one of the most popular desktop distributions that you can get. The nice thing about Ubuntu is they play well with others. And this has been their mantra since probably day one. They really wanted to encourage community and encourage people to develop for Ubuntu. So what they've done is they let people download Ubuntu because it's all free and open source. People download that, and then they create derivative distributions. And what that means is that you could create a distribution of Ubuntu solely for a single purpose. Maybe you like to do, maybe you like to run media. Maybe you like to work on video editing or audio editing or something else. So there's a version of Ubuntu called MediaBuntu that you can download and run. And it's very similar to Ubuntu. So Ubuntu is a good one to try. The interface is a little different, but if you've made the transition from Windows 7 to Windows 8, you're used to a different a transition in interface anyway. But it's very easy. It works great out of the box. All the common drivers are there. There will be some things that you need to install, but overall, Ubuntu is a great one to start with. So I wanted to bring that up first. Now, maybe there's another company out there that you may have heard of called Red Hat. What Red Hat is mainly for business these days. And so they have something called Red Hat Enterprise Linux. Now, this is not something that I would recommend a beginner downloading and installing. It's not meant for beginner users. This is meant to be run in the enterprise. But luckily, Red Hat has a open source sister or daughter project or sister project, if you will, called Fedora. Fedora is where a lot of the development happens that eventually goes into Red Hat Enterprise Linux. And this is really meant to be run on the desktop for the average user. So with Fedora, you get all the advanced features even before they go into Red Hat Enterprise Linux. But it still gives you, if you're familiar with Red Hat or you want to become familiar with Red Hat because you see yourself being a Red Hat administrator someday, this would be a good way to go. Because you're going to get all of the same nomenclature and everything that's in Red Hat. You're going to get that right here in Fedora. Here's what the desktop looks like. It's kind of sparse, but they've gone for a minimalist look. That's one view of the desktop. Everything that you need in Fedora is accessible right here in the activities menu. So that's what Fedora looks like. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Not quite as, for some people, maybe not quite as fancy as Ubuntu, but it does the job. And like I say, if you're interested in learning about Red Hat, Fedora would be one way to go. Another way would be to go with something called CentOS. CentOS is meant to emulate Red Hat Enterprise Linux almost exactly or as much as possible. They take all of the free bits that are published from Red Hat Enterprise Linux, put them in their own distribution. So if you want to run a Red Hat Enterprise Linux server and have it be nearly compatible with everything that Red Hat Enterprise Linux or RHEL is compatible with, CentOS would be a good way to go. So again, you have two options if you want to go with Red Hat compatibility, or if you're looking to become a system administrator, in a big company or something, this would be a good way to go because you'll learn what most people are running in the enterprise. Okay, so those are two options. As I mentioned before, though, there are thousands and thousands of distributions you can download. So where do you go to find out more? I know a lot of people are going to be screaming, oh, you need to talk about Arch, or you need to talk about Gentoo, or you need to talk about some other distribution. Well, we're not going to do that because we don't have time, number one. But there is a place that you can go and see what all the other distributions are. It's called DistroWatch, distrowatch.com. And these folks at DistroWatch, they keep track of all the latest releases that come out for all the distributions or most of the distributions of Linux. And they catalog that. They have a nice little site for news so you can see what's new with Red Hat, what's new with all these other distributions. There's CentOS that I mentioned before. And so they keep track of all these announcements. The other thing they do is they also rank. You'll see over here, if you go to the site and look to the right and scroll down a little bit, you'll see the page hit rankings. And they put this right on the page. And this is one way you know which are the most popular distributions of Linux that you might want to check out. So you can see Ubuntu is there. Debian's there. Fedora that we mentioned is there. OpenSUSE is still there. Novell bought that back in the day, OpenSUSE. That's still used quite a bit in enterprises. And you see Arch and all these other ones. So you can click on those, take a look, see which one is interesting to you. Or maybe, like I said, you're interested in doing something with media, so you want to look for one with media. And you can read all about the various distributions. Now, you see the one at the top here is something called Mint, Linux Mint. And that's the one we're going to be talking about in the next few episodes. Here's what Linux Mint looks like. Linux Mint is the most popular distribution right now. It is one of the derivatives that I mentioned before of Ubuntu. So they take what Ubuntu puts out, and then they customize it and make it their own and change a few widgets here and there and then throw that out to the community. The reason it's quite popular is because they take a lot of the troubleshooting, the first steps that you might have when installing Linux, they take those out of the way. So things like proprietary drivers that you might need for an NVIDIA card or something, those are built in by default and you can install those during installations. Some of the other distributions don't put that in there because they want everything to remain free and open and non-proprietary. And that's understandable. But for people that are just getting started, I find Linux Mint is a great way to go. It has a very similar look and feel to Windows. So you've got a little menu or start button down here. You've got some icons that you can click on quickly to get to things. It should look very similar to what you're used to if you're coming from Windows 7 or if you've used Windows in the past at all, which just about everybody has. So Linux Mint is what I would recommend. It has great support in the community. And this will be a great one to get us started talking about how do you install and what kind of software, how do I add software, how do I keep all of my packages up to date for security reasons and all that kind of stuff that we're going to talk about in some upcoming segments. So that's the one we're going to go with. And next time we'll talk about different ways you can install Linux because there's lots of different options. You can use USB, CD-ROM, all kinds of things. And how do you make room on your PC? Maybe you've got a Windows PC or a Mac. How do you make room on that device so that you can install Linux? Because you may not want to overwrite your existing operating system. So we'll talk all about that in the next segment. Until then, thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.
We want to thank Aaron for giving us the knowledge, the lowdown on some Linux. We've been wanting to do this for a while because we know that there are Linux enthusiasts out there. And it does take time. It's a good thing if you take the time at the beginning to really look through what you need so that you can pick the right distro. Because there's nothing more frustrating than finding the distro that everybody else says is the one you need. Right. And then it's just completely unintuitive.
And then you start to play with it and you don't really like it that much. I like how you're able to preview them now. Because when I was starting to play with Linux, it was you had to burn it to a CD and then start, you know, that way. And then at that point, you were already pretty much into the OS and you were like, oh, okay, I guess I'll just go with this one that I've downloaded. But now you can preview them in the browser, so that's pretty cool.
And now when I started playing around with Linux, remember the computers weren't great. I mean, Linux
they
was
had computers
speedy.
Back then?
You know what?
Sorry.
We had tablets. We were chiseling the code.
Yeah.
No, but it was, you know, I remember I had a friend who was, he was huge into open source. Mm-hmm. And I suggested a distro and he suggests five. And I'm like, so which one should I use? He goes, well, what you want to do is install each one individually and then you can, I'm like, no, I'm not doing that.
That's why I leave it up to the experts like Aaron to, because what he showed me on that too, that day that we recorded that, I learned a lot more. So.
Absolutely. We're going to have him back because, you know, everybody loves an expert. Speaking of experts, one of the things that we love here on Know How is the fact that you, for an hour a week, you open up your knowledge holes.
And we fill it.
And we fill it up with stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Because, you know, the knowledge hole just begs to be filled.
That's
which
right.
is why we have a sponsor now that helps us to fill that knowledge hole. Lynda.com is the one-stop shop for online learning.
Absolutely.
It's not like what you see on, say, YouTube, where you get a lot of those YouTube videos, which are great.
We're on YouTube.
We're on YouTube. We do a lot of this stuff in an amateur style. But every once in a while, when you really want to dig in, you want an organization that's going to put the time and the money into building a studio, to getting the lighting and the audio done right, to getting the editing done right.
Yes.
And that's what Lynda is for. Now, Lynda is known as the leader in online education. They keep you up to date with software, learning brand new skills, and exploring new hobbies with easy-to-follow video tutorials. Whether you want to take better pictures and video with your DSLR, learn the programming skills to develop your own mobile app, or edit your own video footage using Final Cut Pro or Premiere, Lynda.com offers thousands of video courses in a variety of topics. Now, for any software you might rely upon, including Microsoft Office, Adobe Creative Cloud, Final Cut Pro, Logic Pro, and more, Lynda.com can help you stay current with product updates and learn all the ins and outs of your software tools to be more efficient and productive in your professional or personal life. Lynda.com just released a new iPhone and iPad app for iOS 7, and they enhanced their Android app to provide Chromecast support. The iOS app includes a more visual, intuitive interface, and both new apps offer online courses and video viewing, which makes it easy to conveniently learn, even in environments without internet access. Now, Lynda.com users can move seamlessly between mobile and desktop applications. That's one of the things I really enjoy about them, which is you can jump from device to device and, well, just pick up at the lesson that you left off on. Now, one of the things that I've been using Lynda for in the last couple of weeks has been to relearn my Adobe knowledge. You know, we are, Leo just made the announcement, the official announcement, that we've made the switch over to PCs with Premiere. Well, that means we need to be up on our Premiere Pro. It means we need to be up on our Adobe After Effects. And Lynda.com is filling in all the gaps, all the things that I had forgotten. Now, Lynda has over 2,400 courses with more added weekly. All Lynda.com courses are produced at the highest quality, as we said. And they also work with software companies to provide you updated training the same day new versions hit the market, so you'll always have the latest skills. At Lynda.com, the instructors are accomplished professionals at the top of their fields and passionate about teaching. They have courses for all experience levels, from beginner, intermediate, and advanced. And whether you have 15 minutes or 15 hours, each course is structured so that you can learn from start to finish. You can search the transcripts to find quick answers or read along with video. They also offer certificates of completion when you finish a course, which you can publish to your LinkedIn profile, which is great if you're a professional in the field. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to learn something new with Lynda.com. It's only $25 a month for access to the entire Lynda.com course library. Or for $37.50 a month, you can subscribe to the premium plan, which includes exercise files that let you follow along with the instructor's projects using the exact same assets. And you can try Lynda.com right now with a free 7-day trial. Visit Lynda.com/knowhow to access the entire library. That's over 2,400 courses free for 7 days. It's all at lynda.com/knowhow. And we thank Lynda for their support of know-how.
Kind of like with Shutterstock, I've gotten lost looking at the GoPro how-tos on there.
Yeah, seriously, I'm really big into all the Adobe Suite programs. In fact, I hate to kind of admit this, but I'm still kind of a Photoshop noob. I've used it for, you know, 20 years.
Yeah. But
I'm not. I can like cut and paste and color stuff. But so I'm looking at this guy's
faces.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's how you use layers. Got it.
Sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. And so
cool stuff.
Yeah. So you know, it helps me to kind of build that up without having to tell the world that, as I just did,
that you're not so good at Photoshop.
Damn.
I don't know. The thing I use Photoshop usually is to like move people's heads around and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's pretty much all you need, right?
But anyway.
Okay, now let's
get on to the next thing.
We've been playing with this. This is our lunchbox build. It's a classic RC model. It's a 1/12th scale, sort of a monster truck type thing.
Can we get this shot, Alex? Do we have this? Do we have this shot? Yeah, look at that.
Thank you. Yeah. Now, this is actually our second. We had to get a second one.
We had to get two.
Because we have two hosts, so we needed two, but it was really because we were pretty sure we're going to break something and we wanted a backup.
Oh, yeah.
So it wouldn't affect the shooting. Yeah.
Judging from past experiences, we need probably two of everything. Two Raspberry Pis, two lunchboxes.
We blow things up a lot. But, okay, so we last time we talked about the RC project, we talked a little bit about how it gets controlled, about the receivers, the transmitters, the servos.
The crystals.
The crystals. We talked a little bit about the power plant, about how the motor works, the electronic speed controller. Now we need to talk a little bit about the wheels, about the shock absorption,
right,
and about a little bit in the transmission.
Right, right. Well, I guess we should start from the bottom going up, right?
Yeah,
because the first thing that contacts the ground is going to be the tire. So these are the tires for the lunchbox. They got these little rubber tires, and then inside is the rim.
Rip this thing off.
Are you going to take it off there?
Because Gojira.
I spent a lot of time putting the tires on.
Oh, pull up your tires, Nancy. There we go. So this is what
this
the wheel
looks
like.
This is why we needed
like.
Two of them.
Yeah, so if you... Yeah, that's what the actual wheel looks like. Now, right. this is a steering wheel, not a driving wheel. The way that you know the difference is this just goes onto a spindle. So there's no way to actually drive this.
And here's the driving wheel.
That's the driving wheel. So you've got a little little pinions that will grab onto those spokes to drive, give it power, give it motion. Now, here's one of the things that we were researching is these are cool because we like monster tires.
Yeah.
But when you build a model or any vehicle with tires that are this big that have this much volume.
So much of a gap, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of gap. It gets kind of bouncy.
Right. Which, yeah, the lunchbox is intended for some off-road use. I mean, that's why it's got these monster tires. And if you hit, like, a rock or something, it's just going to deflect and bounce around. So we were trying to come up with some ideas of how to negate that. And
right.
So one of them was we were thinking about putting some foam inside along the rim.
Yeah, foam insert. So these are 2.2 inches. So if you get a 2.2 inch foam insert that goes right onto this wheel, what it will do is it will give this a maximum compression. So it will compress about that much before it hits the foam, and then it gives it much more resistance to compress anymore.
Right.
So it gives you cushioning, right, but it doesn't give you like a firm, super bouncy ride.
And then the other thing we were thinking is if we plug the hole, because there's little holes on the rim, plug those up, but then there's nowhere for the air to go, which means it's a balloon, so it's going to bounce off of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to have a little bit of give.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, you know, when people say, oh, I've got low-profile tires. Well, what a low-profile tire does is it deforms less under acceleration or turning.
Right.
This, because you've got so much space between the wheel and the edge of the tire, every time you bump, every time you move, you're going to deform this tire in some way, and in deforming it, you're going to change the characteristics of how it turns or how it accelerates. Adding a little stiffness to the tire gives you a bit more control. But again, like we said, if we were to plug this up so you don't get that air escaping, mm-hmm, this would essentially become a balloon, and balloons bounce, and that's not necessarily what you want out of the handling for your RC vehicle.
Yep, and so I think the only other thing, as far as the tires go, is that if you're following along with this project and you're going to be putting these on, make sure that the treads are going the right way.
Yeah, that's actually happened on more than one build. just remember the little chevron goes forward.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So you've got you could tell from the rims that the lunchbox is a rear wheel drive vehicle. So there are all wheel drive RC cars out there, but lunchbox is rear wheel drive.
Oops. Yeah. Now, do you want to talk a little bit about shocks?
Suspension. Yes. So connected to these, I mean, helping out the lunchbox absorb all those impacts and stuff, it actually has a coilover system, which is what you'd find on a lot of vehicles today.
Damn. It's essentially just this inside that. There's a plate on either end so that every time the suspension impacts the ground, it will compress and then it will want to go back up. It actually looks a lot like this. So if you look at this model, this is also using a coilover model. There's no oil in here. It's just a spring that's connected to two mounting points. And every time the arm moves, because it makes an impact, it will absorb some of the shock and then push it back out. which is good. I mean, that's a good shock absorption system. The problem with something like this is it makes everything bounce. If all you have is a spring, there, I mean, this thing is, it's going to be bouncing all over the place, and that's horrible for handling.
Yeah. You're gonna hit a rock, and it's just, the whole thing's gonna be unsettled.
Right.
What you want to do is have the wheel connected to the ground without it, you know, either being pushed off the ground or being too stiff. So it's a very
nice balance.
A balance. Yeah. Keep the chassis balanced as much as you can.
And unfortunately, you're not gonna get that balance with the shock that comes in the. Actually, it's just the coilover spring that comes in the kit. What we are gonna do is we've decided. We're going to build this with aftermarket parts so that you can get oil-filled shocks. And shocks do a couple of things.
Yeah.
They do have a coilover so that it allows it to push back after it's been compressed. But because it has an oil-filled shock, which is just basically a piston inside of a cylinder, it means that the compression when it's under duress is not going to happen as quickly. It's not going to like just go boink. It's going to fight against the oil, and then when it comes back, it's also going to fight against the oil,
right.
So that you're not going to get that bouncing. In fact,
that oscillating thing from the springs.
Yes, you want to stop the oscillation. So whereas one of these coilovers with big bouncy tires would oscillate like this, an oil filled shock would kind of dampen it out.
Yep.
And that's what you want.
That's yep. Yeah. So should we probably do one lunchbox with the oil filled ones, and then the other one without, and just see how they kind of handle side by side.
Yeah.
Now, I want the one with the oil-filled shocks, though.
Fine.
No, it's fine.
I'm going to put extra stuff in mine, though.
What? I would not be surprised if I came in and saw that yours had, like, a turbo kit attached to it or something.
I may have already built it. Okay, no, the other part that we want to talk about are bearings. Now, your kit is going to come with these, if you could. These are just...
Those look really cheap to me.
These are sleeve bearings. They're not actual bearings. They're just bushings, really.
Yeah.
So the idea is when you've got moving parts. So this is the drive shaft that's going to go into this. This is the actual transmission housing. So eventually, this is going to go through here, and it's going to connect to the tire. Well, you need points to support this and this. Right here, because you want this shaft free spinning inside this housing, correct?
Right.
Well, the way that it does that is it uses these thrust bearings to provide that support, right? So now it can freely rotate. Now, these are not bad. I mean, plastic bearings will work just fine. Yeah. The problem is they actually have a lot of friction because they don't actually move. They just slide.
Right. And that's what you want to reduce the friction. That's the whole point of them, right?
Right, because friction robs power. Anytime you have more friction, you're going to rob power. And also, these tend to deform after time. So if you put your lunchbox through a lot of rough maneuvers, which...
You'll be replacing these eventually.
Yeah. So we got these instead. These are ball bearings. So compare these to these thrust bearings.
And they're not expensive. I mean, I think they're what, like
the kit was like $10
or something on
Amazon? For the entire set of ball bearings for your lunchbox. What these do is they're ball bearings. There's exactly that's what you have balls inside two sleeves, and they're oil filled. So when you have the outside sleeve rotating, the inner sleeve will maintain still, which means it's going to reduce the amount of friction that your system is going to feel.
It means you're putting more power to the ground.
Exactly. Less friction, more power goes to the wheels. So if you go and do the close-up, the way it would work is instead of the thrust bearings, you would have these ball bearings. And believe it or not, this flows so much easier. It's so much more fluid, and they're much less prone to deformation.
Yeah.
So you can run your kit rough, and you're not going to have to worry about replacing the sleeves after a couple of weeks or months.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Yeah. So this is a preliminary step, but we just want to show you some of the technology that's going to go into the build.
We're getting started.
Next week, we're actually going to show you how the transmission comes together.
Yes. I had no idea that it was that, not complicated, but like...
There's a lot of parts
real car
in there. Yeah. A lot of people think, so it's a motor connected to wheels. No, these RC kits.
Have a transmission.
There's a transmission. There's a gear differential. Yeah. There's gear reductions. There's a pinion that goes under the motor. It's pretty cool.
It is. Because we're both kind of motorheads, So this is the kind of stuff that we like to geek out on. And hopefully some people out there are going to follow along with this or maybe get interested in building their own after the fact.
Eka Kardinsky is saying, well, just coat it in butter.
Yeah,
because what you want is you want your remote control car to smell like rotting butter. That's...
You know what? Use bacon grease, actually. Not only does it smell delicious, but it lasts forever.
All right. Now, let's get serious for a second. We're going to put on your black hat. Oh, man, we should have brought out the black hats. We're going to get a little black hat right now. Let me say right now, the knowledge that I'm about to teach you, do not use it for evil. Please, 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 please.
We should have like a little bar that goes across. Please don't do evil.
In fact, if you know that you don't have the moral fortitude to not use this incorrectly,
turn off the stream right now.
Okay? Because what we're going to do... Thank you. Oh, Alex.
Oh. Alex doesn't have the moral fortitude to not do this.
What we're going to do is I'm going to show you how a man, one of the easiest man in the middle attacks work. Now, it doesn't just have to be an attack. Remember in previous episodes of Know How, we showed them how to tap their network, right?
Right.
How to look at the traffic that's flowing over the network. This is another way to do it. It's just using a slightly different vector.
Oh, so, okay. Okay, it may not be your network.
It may not be. Yeah. No, maybe not. All right, now let's look at this board. So this is the diagram from last week. This is what a typical computer network looks like.
We like to recycle our
We love to recycle because my drawing skills are horrible. All right, so what we're dealing with on this episode is just the router and the devices that are on the network. Now, you may think that your device talks to, let's say, computer A talks to computer B. You may think it talks via the IP address, right? Because that's what we type in.
Yeah.
192.168.200.201. That's not true. Oh. Inside the network, they actually talk via MAC addresses.
Okay, right. And each device has its own...
It's unique. Right,
MAC
the media
address.
Access control. So every device has a unique 6-byte hexadecimal code. So, for example, 11111111111. It would never be like that.
But no. That's an example.
So the way it works is in order for them to find out, if let's say... Computer A wants to talk to computer B, and it knows computer B is 192.168.200.201. It can't just send something to 192.168.200.201 because that means nothing to this network. It means nothing to the switch. It has to find out what computer is actually attached to 192.168.200.201. So what it does is it does an ARP broadcast.
ARP.
Yeah.
What does that stand for?
So ARP is a protocol that we have in networking. It's a way for computers to find out what is actually connected to particular addresses.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So it's called the address resolution protocol.
Okay.
So what this is going to do is it's going to do a broadcast. It's going to broadcast the entire network and say, hey, who's 192.168.200.201? And that will go to all the devices that are connected to the network. Computer B is going to hear the broadcast. It's going to say, oh, hey, I'm 192.168.200.201, and my MAC address is 01ABEF793C5E.
And then the other computer is like, cool, I'm going to send you...
I'm going to send you my thing, right. Yeah. And it's also going to cache that, so it doesn't have to do it again. So if it ever has to send to 192.168.200.201, it knows, oh... That's the MAC address that he gave me before, and I just send the packet. It doesn't have to rebroadcast. It's our packet. Okay? That's called the ARP cache. So as you have a network that continues to work, all the devices will slowly learn all the other devices.
What IP is attached to what MAC.
Okay. Exactly. So that's how it works. Now, let's say I have a computer that wants to talk to the Internet. What it will do is it needs to get to, when it gets its DHCP address, remember, you know how it has like the gateway?
Yeah.
Default gateway is 192.168.200.1.
Right.
It knows that that's the gateway it needs to send
data to
get to the Internet. So it's going to do the same thing. It's going to say, hey, I need to get to the Internet. What device is 192.168.200.1? Because that's my gateway.
Right.
The router is going to hear the broadcast. It's going to say, oh, that's me.
Yeah.
I'm 192.168.200.1, and my MAC address is 00000000000000.
Is that always the case on routers?
No, that will change. Remember, these are unique.
I didn't know routers had MAC addresses.
They always have MAC addresses.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
In fact, they have two, one from the outside and one for the inside.
Wow, yeah. Okay. And then it's like, okay, here's the Internet. Go ahead.
Exactly. So it just passes it on to the router. The router passes it on to the Internet. The router gets it back from the Internet and passes it on to the individual computer.
Okay.
That's the gateway. Okay. Mm. So, that's how communications on your network works.
Right.
Here's how an ARP cache attack, a man-in-the-middle attack works. Computer A says, hey, I need to send something to the Internet. Who's 192.168.200.1? The router's going to say, oh, that's me. Here's my MAC address.
Mm-hmm.
my attack computer will hear that because this is all broadcasted, right? So it hears everything. It goes, oh, okay, so 192.168.200.200 has that MAC address, and the router, 192.168.200.1, has this MAC address. And after the router has replied, my computer will start screaming. It will start broadcasting, no, 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 no. I'm 192.168.200.1.
I see where this is going.
And this is my MAC address. So Mike, the computer's going to go, oh, okay, that
I'll
must
send
be
it to you then.
So instead of the packet going from the computer to the router to the internet,
it goes to the attack computer.
From the computer to the attack computer.
And then the attack computer
to the
passes
router,
it to the router.
To the internet.
So it collects everything. It's like the hub or what
it's,
we,
yeah, it's like when we're dealing with the hub, right? This is just like a tap. This is this is a very basic man in the middle attack. That's how it works. And what it will do is it will give you traffic in both directions, because when the packet comes back from the internet, it's going to go from the internet to the router. The router is going to say, oh, but this was from 192.168.200.200, but this is pretending to be 200.
Right.
So it's going to go through that computer back to that computer.
Okay. Now I know how that works. But is there going to be any noticeable bandwidth issues because it's passing through another device?
Yes and no. No, in the sense that a typical user is probably not going to. How many times have you tried to get something like, I guess the internet's just slow?
Yeah, a lot.
You don't notice it, right? It fades in the background. So you just go, oh, I guess the network must be a little slow. You're not going to think someone must be
on
running a man in the middle attack on me.
Oh, sneaky. Yeah.
So now we're not just theory. We're going to show you how it works.
Oh, cool.
This is the part we're going to get in trouble for.
Duh.
All right. So the program that I want to show you is called Cain-Enable. It's kind of a standard.
Wait, isn't that biblical?
It's a little biblical. It's a little biblical. Alex, if you go ahead and show them that website that's linked in the document. Right. So this is where you get Cain-Enable from.
This looks legit, Padre.
this is a legitimate security tool as long as you use it on networks that you own. The minute you use this on a network you do not own, I disown you. You are an evil, evil person, and I hope they catch you.
I just like knowing how this stuff works. It doesn't necessarily mean I want to do something malicious.
Yeah, it does.
Oh, what? Well, me, yes.
You're a bad person. Okay. So, no, if you go to computer on input 11, I believe it's this. Thank you. So I've got Cain-Enable loaded up. I already downloaded. I installed it. It's a very small program. It installs very, very quickly. Here's how it's going to work. What I need to do is I need to set up my attack. So the first thing I need to do is know what computers are on the network. So I'm going to go ahead and go to the sniffer tab right here. There we go. So that's my sniffer. And I want to find out what's on my network. So I'm going to hit the plus sign. Actually, I have to turn on the sniffer first. I'm going to turn on the sniffer, and then I'm going to hit the plus sign. And I'm going to say, search for everything that's in my subnet, all the computers that are on my network.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, there we go. So now it's told me it sees two different devices, 192.168.1.1 and 192.168.1.108. 1.1
is the router.
Is the router. Yeah. 1.108 is this other computer here.
Okay.
It's my second laptop. Okay, so now I know the computer's on their network. I want to intercept all the traffic that runs between this computer
and the router.
So what I do is I switch over to the ARP tab down here. Okay, and now I'm going to go ahead and this was from a previous run. Let me get rid of those. I'm going to add a new attack by hitting the plus. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say I want to see everything that goes between 192.168.1.1 and 192.168.1.108. Add that rule. There we go. Okay. Now I have to click this little button that looks like the radioactive symbol, and you'll see.
Safe.
Down below, you see it's starting the attack. So it's, okay, full routing. That now means it's inserted itself. It's now the man in the middle. So any traffic that runs between the second computer and the router is now actually coming through this computer. Now, what can I do with that? Oh, I don't know. Let's do this. If you watch the previous episodes of Know How on Wireshark, we're going to start up Wireshark. Because now that we're receiving all those packets on this computer, I'm going to say, go ahead and tell me what's coming over the LAN. And there we go. So now it's showing me everything that's coming between those two computers. Huh. I'm going to put a DNS filter here, so it's only going to show me the DNS entries. Again, watch the previous episode of Know How if you want to know exactly how this works.
Right.
And now I'm going to go over to this computer, and I'm going to let's go to twit.tv.
Yeah.
All right. So twit.tv. Okay. No, actually, you have to go back to the other computer. So, and now look at the DNS entries. It's finding all the different websites that are attached to that twit.tv. So anytime you type in twit.tv, you're getting all these different websites that are being called. But this is just a probe, and we're not actually going to probe through the data. It's just showing you. I'm now intercepting
what's coming from that laptop to the router.
Right. Yeah. Go ahead and come back to the wide shot. So this is now a man in the middle between this and the router that's under the desk.
This is now the tap, like the tap that we did in that previous episode.
Except it's a software tap rather than a hardware tap.
Right.
What we did before is we physically had a device that would give us a mirror for all the packets that were flowing through our network. Right. This is fooling all the devices on the network. It's saying, I'm the router, give me the packets you have going to the internet.
Wow.
Now, I can choose with this system, with Kane Enable, I can choose to see the packets just flowing between two devices. So let's say the computer and the router, or computer A and computer B. Or
all
I could say, give me everything on the network.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
That's
now,
cool.
This will work really, really well in your home network or unprotected networks.
Yeah.
If a network is set up correctly, like the way I set up networks, is every time a user logs in, he gets his own VLAN. So if he did a scan, there's no one else on his network. He can run the attack all he wants. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work.
Right.
But if you ever run in, let's say you're lonely at night and you've got nothing better to do and you're in a hotel and you plug into the network and...
You're not speaking from experience at all.
And you find out that there's a lot of computers on the network and you start running a man-in-the-middle attack and it works. You can get passwords. You can get DNS. And something actually, chat clients, like AOL Messenger, all used to be unprotected.
Right.
So you could see conversations in real time. It was actually kind of weird.
Wow. Well, so a more legitimate thing to do. Would this be a better way of seeing what's going on your network?
Exactly. And that's why we're showing it. That's the legitimate use. People were saying, well, you showed us a tap, but I can't find a tap, or I don't want to buy a tap.
Right.
You don't have to.
This is the way you could find out which computer on your network is sucking up all the bandwidth.
Exactly. Because it works the same way. Now, I will say this. If you're doing it this way, there are serious limitations because all the traffic will be flowing through your connection and then back out through your connection.
Right. So you'll get that thing. Well, I guess the internet's just slow
today. You're going to bottleneck everything. And not only that, our cache spoofing is not always 100% effective. So you may miss some packets.
Okay.
But it is a really good way. If you suspect that there's a device in your network that is like hogging up all the bandwidth, this is actually a really good way to figure out if that actually is the device and what it's connecting to.
Very cool.
Yeah. Now, we are going to give you all the notes for this because we know that this was a little substantial.
It was intense.
But it's a step-by-step process. Seriously, even if you have none of the security software installed on your computer right now, you could be up and running in about 45 minutes.
Yeah. Very cool.
Just please, 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 please.
Disclaimer.
Please don't use this for nefarious purposes. Okay. And if you happen to use it for nefarious purposes and get arrested, don't tell them a priest told you to do it.
Well, also, it's like if you want to get more tips from us, you have to play nice. And then Padre will tell you more stuff.
Yeah, we're gonna take you down security aisle. This is a nice, easy way to get your hack on.
Yeah.
That
was cool.
Pick up some Kane Enable.
Man, so we learned Linux, which Linux you would want to start with. We talked about suspension systems on RC cars. And then we went back to security on a network.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, we've been all over the place today.
It's been a weird day. I think that's good work.
I think
right?
My knowledge hole is pretty full
it's
right now.
It's full. It's full. It's been cemented over.
Yeah.
Now, if you do want to find out anything else about some of the topics that we talked about, including the notes for the Kane Enable hack or what we're doing on our build, be sure to go to our show page at, where is that?
That would be twit.tv/KH.
Right. You can also reach us if you want to email us at
At Jeff Needles.
At Jeff. No, don't do it. Seriously, we won't. We won't check it. It's yeah.
It's just easier for us. Just go to Twitter. Go to the Google Plus page. I never remember the Google Plus.
By the way, our Google Plus shortener has run out, so
yeah.
We're gonna have to fix that. Just go to Google Plus and search for the Know How page. You'll find us. Be my smiling face because no one has sent us a picture yet that includes a hippo.
Yeah, no, we haven't changed the album art yet. That's. No.
We need to look on Shutterstock for that hippo.
I like that idea.
Hippo for you. Also, you can find us on Twitter. You can find me at Padre Estray.
And you can find me at Cranky_Hippo.
Yeah. And until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballister.
And I'm Brian Burnett.
And now that you know,
go do it.
These donuts are terrible, Brian.